Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Hurricane Fiona has strengthened into a Category 4 storm, with Bermuda now in its path. Fiona's damage and devastation can be seen from the Dominican Republic, Turks and Caicos, and Puerto Rico, where many are still without power, clean water, and any comfort of stability. Fiona happened on the near 5-year anniversary of Hurricane Maria, and Puerto Ricans were still rebuilding when Fiona, a less severe storm, struck. The reasons are rooted in Puerto Rico's complicated and painful history with the United States. Although by law, U.S. territories are treated equally, if you ask Boricuas, those native or born in Puerto Rico, many would say that is far from the truth. Bianca Grallo is an independent journalist who returned to Puerto Rico to tell the underreported realities that take place in her home, and it has paid dividends in the years since. Just before Fiona struck, Bianca's investigative work was the subject of Bad Bunny's new music video. He is one of the biggest stars in the world and also Puerto Rican, and he transformed his platform into a documentary with Bianca at the forefront, highlighting displacement and gentrification in Puerto Rico. It was a feat to get in touch with Bianca, understandably navigating Hurricane Fiona without power and water herself, but we were able to connect for about 15 minutes yesterday. Bianca, the fact that you and I are talking right now is pretty far from guaranteed. You're navigating so many obstacles. I just want to check in. How have the last 24 hours been for you and your family?
I'm incredibly lucky that I have family members that have generators and have the resources to keep them running, water reserves. So I've been good, and it's because I have their support. If I were by myself at home, then it would be a lot harder without electricity, you know, and I was just reflecting on what all of that means, you know. So I looked in my fridge, all the stuff in there starting to rot. I can't turn on a fan because there's no electricity. When there's no electricity, a lot of times there's no running water. That's the current situation. So then it's hard to use the bathroom. So your day-to-day life becomes about solving all these issues to just have the basics.
Where are you located in Puerto Rico?
In the northwest part of the island.
We're talking on a Tuesday afternoon in your time. You know, as it stands, I mean, power was just knocked out to the island. You brought up an issue of clean water. Where does all of that stand right now?
So right now, we do have most of Puerto Rico still in the dark. At last check, they were only able to give power back to a few 100,000 people. So that means there's close to 1 million people that still don't have power. And with the running water, same thing. You have hundreds of thousands of people that don't have running water right now. That was similar to the situation after Hurricane Maria. You know, you had a lot of rivers. We depend on our rivers for clean water, and those rivers, you know, the water is dirty right now, and the rivers have gone out of and flooded the municipality. So then there are a lot of people that don't have those basic services.
Given that we don't have to go that far back to remember the devastation from Hurricane Maria, this happened on the near 5-year anniversary, and Puerto Ricans are still on a long road to recovery. When you all were preparing for Hurricane Fiona, which was a Category 1 when it went through Puerto Rico, were you preparing for what the aftermath that you're currently experiencing right now?
Yeah, we were. But the thing that people have to remember is that we go from one crisis to another, right? And that doesn't have to be a big hurricane. It could just be the power outages that we were suffering a couple of weeks ago. So yes, people prepare the best they can, but it's also a matter of whether they can afford it or not. You know, generators are not cheap. Fuel right now is really expensive. So I was just reflecting on the fact that, you know, life in Puerto Rico is expensive for people, especially in a place with such high percentage of poverty and where wages don't keep up with the cost of living. And then on top of that, you have to be buying all these extra things just to survive here because you don't have the basic services that people take for granted in other places.
You touched upon the blackouts that were occurring over the summer. Why have they been happening?
So there are many reasons, and every time there's an outage, you know, as journalists, we ask the questions and investigations take place. But the reason people are so frustrated is because some of these outages are because of lack of maintenance. The one that we saw back in April that knocked power out for all of Puerto Rico, they're investigating. In fact, this week they're supposed to submit the report of what exactly happened. But we know that it was because of lack of maintenance in one of the plants that caused an explosion. Most recently, there was another outage that left a quarter of a million people without electricity. And the private company that took over distribution admitted that part of the reason that happened was because of lack of maintenance with trees that interfere with power lines. So that's why people are so frustrated, because, yes, we have an old system and an electrical grid that needs a lot of, like, fixing and rebuilding. But at the same time, we know that the people in charge of giving maintenance so that this doesn't continue to happen have been failing at some of those tasks.
I was talking to a disaster researcher about how Hurricane Fiona is just compounding the long road to recovery from Hurricane Maria. And you just touched upon it's not only hurricanes, it's one crisis to another to another. What was Puerto Rico like last week before Hurricane Fiona hit compared to how it is now?
Well, you know, like I said, we have been going through outages. So maybe not an outage that has lasted 3 days. Like right now we're into day three of this outage, but people were regularly losing power in some areas. And sometimes we lose running water too. So I think the difference is when it becomes sustained, when, you know, it's several days of not having these services. And then on top of that, you have people dealing with severe flooding who have lost everything they had and had to be rescued from their homes. So it's just an already not ideal situation that has just continued to get worse. And then you have a huge hurricane that just, you know, takes us back to like square one, where we have to like rebuild again. So many people who were just recovering from Hurricane Maria are now dealing with these losses again.
When looking at images, I believe nearly 1,000 people have been rescued from floodwaters. And I go back to this video. I think I saw it on Instagram from CBS, a bridge that was built following Maria just effectively like crumbled under Hurricane Fiona. Mm-hmm. Why is that happening? Why are we seeing strikingly similar parallels 5 years later?
And that's a good question, right? Those are the questions we've been asking. Those were the questions we were asking in, you know, year one, year two, year three after the hurricane. Why is the recovery taking so long? Why is it so slow? And it's a combination of many factors. With the information we have right now, we know that there have been failures at every level of government, from federal government, where politics have gotten in the way of Puerto Rico, you know, getting the same kind of support that another state would, to the local government that has had many failures in how to recover from that hurricane with the federal funds that are available. So the answer is not a simple one. And just last week, there was a hearing, a congressional hearing talking about this. We're going to have another one this week, but there are going to be some tough questions. And both the local and the federal government are going to have to answer why. Why are people having to still suffer the consequences of such slow governmental action?
Territories are supposed to be treated equally under U.S. law. But when you talk to Puerto Ricans, do they feel that that's the case?
No, absolutely not. And I think it's becoming clearer to everyone that Puerto Rico is a modern-day colony and it's treated as such. So, you know, these are issues that go back hundreds of years and that still today Puerto Ricans are feeling the effects of that.
And you're part of that change. I mean, you're an independent journalist. You are doing incredible investigative work in Puerto Rico, which is your home. I've learned so much about Puerto Rico from your reporting. I would just imagine with this latest crisis, with Hurricane Fiona, you're seeing the intersection of everything you've been investigating over the years unfolding in this aftermath.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, I think it becomes a lot more present for people outside of Puerto Rico because they're seeing the devastating images and they're hearing about it in the news. But to be honest with you, it's just what we live day to day. Every day we're reminded of these issues because if it's not a hurricane, there are many other things, you know, the lack of agriculture that allows us to have food security. You know, the lack of services like quality education and good schools for kids to attend. There's so many issues that remind Puerto Ricans on a daily basis about the failures that had led us to this point. The hurricane just magnifies all of that.
Yeah, and you've also reported on displacement due to tax incentives as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's another very present issue, the lack of affordable housing and gentrification in people's communities. You know, they deal with that every day.
What is the need right now for Puerto Ricans? How can people help?
So my hope is always set on the community groups. I'm talking grassroots community groups that have dedicated their free time to help their neighbors. So I, in my experience reporting on these issues for a while, we have a saying in Puerto Rico that says, solo el pueblo salva el pueblo. You know, people save people. It is the communities that will save themselves. And that's what we're seeing. And, you know, we're seeing community kitchens for people to feed their neighbors. They're handing out supplies, checking in on everyone. And we've even seen rescues from neighbors during flooding. So my recommendation for everyone who has Puerto Rico close to their heart is to look at those community groups that are doing the work. And the reason they do such work is because they know their communities. They know their needs. And if you've seen any like amazing recovery since the hurricane, a lot of it, you've seen it from these groups. So I think they're the ones to go to help and support people going through this right now.
Finally, Bianca, you know, this was also a big week for you as a journalist. Bad Bunny, who's one of the biggest musicians in the world, used his platform to highlight your investigative journalism into a documentary in his latest music video. Do you think we're at an inflection point where Puerto Ricans are getting the attention that historically they haven't gotten and is long overdue?
Yeah, I think there's a message there. You know, if you enjoy our music, if you enjoy your beaches and paradise when you come visit, then you should also care about the issues that affect our people. And yes, I'm very excited and honored to have had such platform, because I do think that it moves that message further, and we've been seeing that. So I'm very pleased to see how many people are taking interest in these issues that, to be honest with you, are not just particular and unique to Puerto Rico, right? We see these issues throughout Latin America and many other countries. So I think there's also that empathy and connection, because other people know exactly what it's like to go through those issues. So I'm happy to see that bond be strengthened with our siblings from other countries, so that, you know, we can imagine and create a better future.
Where's your reporting taking you next?
There's so much work. I have a list of stories that I was working on before that I'll continue to work on next. But, you know, my heart and my presence is here in Puerto Rico, so I'll continue to report from here.
Thank you so much, Bianca, for taking the time. You're just navigating so much right now, and we just really appreciate you joining us from Puerto Rico.
Thank you so much.
And that is independent journalist Bianca Grallo, who joined us from Puerto Rico discussing the impact of Hurricane Fiona. Up next, wildfires are transforming some of California's most iconic landscapes. We'll head to the sequoias in Yosemite and get a look at the scale of the impact amid an escalating intensity and scale of wildfires. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. California's giant sequoias. They are one of our state's most majestic, beautiful, and precious national treasures. People come from all over the world to see them, flocking to national parks like Yosemite. But over the past several years, California's intensifying and changing climate has caused an enormous amount of damage to sequoia groves. Whether it's wildfires turning into monstrous trees into ash, or weeks and weeks of choking smoke filling the air, or even the extremes of our dry seasons parching their roots and branches, climate change and especially wildfires are literally transforming our landscape. Those who study sequoias in hopes of protecting them for thousands of more years are very concerned about their future. As the environment changes, so is the way researchers are thinking how much more the giant trees will be able to endure and the future of national parks in California as a whole. CAP Radio environment reporter Manola Sakaida is here to share what she found on a recent trip to Yosemite right in the middle of wildfire season. Manola, thanks for making the trip.
Happy to be here.
What brought you to Yosemite?
Right. So obviously, when it comes to the most iconic of national parks, Yosemite is definitely up there. It's kind of the place you think of in California when you think of family road trips, when you just think of picturesque, unchanging environments. And obviously, giant sequoias are part of that. But also part of that is the fact that wildfires all over the state are just really challenging the idea of an environment that stays the same, something that we can really depend on. And there was even a fire this year inside Yosemite, right, near the town of Wawona, which is this small community located in the park. So, you know, with all of that in mind, I kind of wanted to see how these fires are impacting the people who work there, who live there, you know, the Park Service, how they're managing this, and, you know, also just how wildfires are changing the face of the park. So I spent a couple nights in Yosemite while the Oak Fire was still in the process of being contained. That was pretty close by. I came to Wawona shortly after an evacuation order had just been lifted, so all the residents had returned, but it was actually going to be another day till visitors could return. So, you know, when I was there, it was really odd day to be there. You know, it was really empty. It was really smoky because of the nearby fire. Just totally not how you'd normally see Yosemite at the end of July, which was when I was there. So, you know, I talked to shop owners and other people in the area. And the one message I just really kept hearing was that the situation made them worry about the future of the park. You know, a lot of people that live there depend on visitor revenue. So what happens when no one can come to the park anymore? That's something people were thinking about. I think there had been, you know, when I was there, I didn't really see a lot of people, obviously. I just saw a lot of, like, fire trucks and, you know, the few people that live there. And it's not just the future businesses in and around the park, but, you know, everything is changing. And a lot of research is done in Yosemite, so that's having to change, too.
Right. A tremendous amount of research is done at Yosemite. How is that evolving as the landscape of Yosemite is changing?
Right. So as a whole, we've seen hundreds of thousands of acres of land burn because of these wildfires in the past few years. And a lot of that has been in the area of national parks. And, you know, there's really obvious impacts like decimated ecosystems and also just researchers having to rethink what they've thought about these areas for the longest time. You know, so many of the researchers I've talked to in the last year, not just for this story, but for other stories, have often explained to me that they've had to change their research in some way. You know, maybe they came in thinking they would study one thing and then wildfires came in. Or they were doing research in an area and then suddenly that area, you know, burned to a crisp. So they had to kind of reorient. And, you know, for some of the researchers I've been talking to, all these changes are just generally making them feel like they don't even know the field of research that they focus on as well as they once did. So one of the people I talked to in Wawona was Breezy Jackson, and that was kind of her story. She's a fire ecologist and the director of UC Merced's Yosemite and Sequoia field stations, and she lives in Wawona and often is assisting visiting researchers with their work.
What's changed for me is that I no longer trust my own understanding of fire behavior. I mean, I'm a fire ecologist. My dad was a firefighter my whole life growing up. I've been a firefighter myself. I've lived in fire country my whole life. I've been a fire lookout. I know fire. And what we're seeing now is so far outside my frame of reference and my understanding that I don't trust my own judgment and intuition. So when I look at the map of the fire, I look at the weather forecast, I can see in my mind where the fire is on the terrain that I've hiked and been in. I develop a picture in my mind of what's going to happen with that fire. And now I can't trust that picture because everything is different. It just keeps surprising me.
And Breezy is someone who's lived in Winona for over 10 years, or Yosemite, I should say. She's kind of lived in different parts of the park. So, you know, for her, this is really shocking. And like I said, this is not an unusual story from researchers.
I mean, Manola, that's just so profound. I mean, what she just said was, I no longer trust my own understanding of fire behavior as a fire ecologist. And when looking at Yosemite, the landscape, the vegetation, I mean, it's been there for centuries, even in some cases millennia. How is the natural part of Yosemite changing?
Right. So that's kind of where giant sequoias come in as a really good example of that. And I've been learning about giant sequoias over the past year just because they've come up so frequently as this example.
They're humbling to see, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And I got to spend a lot of time with them in person. And it was, I mean, they're gorgeous. I mean, if you haven't seen them, I hope anyone listening can go while they're there. And obviously in Yosemite, they are safe for now. And anyways, the basic story of giant sequoias for the longest time has been that they're indestructible, that they're, you know, they can live for thousands of years. They've been historically resilient to drought and bug infestation. They've also adapted to wildfires in their, you know, natural environment, so they can survive low to moderate wildfires. And that's just something that is part of their life cycle. But that's not really the case for the wildfires we're seeing now. These trees are adapted to moderate fires, but now we're seeing these high intensity, severe, catastrophic fires that are way too intense for these trees. So many have been killed off as a result in recent years. And, you know, one example is the Castle Fire in 2020, where we saw more than 10,000 giant sequoias were burned and killed. So I talked to Garrett Dickman about this. He helped me put it in perspective. He's a forest ecologist for Yosemite National Park and another researcher whose work has had to pivot and focus on wildfires. He told me that he's worked on some of these huge fires and, you know, had to account for the damage himself.
I walk through stands of giant sequoias and count the dead ones. And you just see thousands of years tick away on your fingertips. And they're gone. They're not going to be replaced in our lifetime or our children's lifetime or the lifetime after that. It's generations upon generations before that those trees could reproduce if everything goes well, and they may not.
So my question, you know, after learning this was, you know, well, have giant sequoias died by fire before? You know, how abnormal is this? Obviously, this is a really dramatic story. But, you know, a lot of people say our environment changes. You know, there has been, you know, extreme fires in our history before. But what Garrett told me that was that, you know, it is pretty abnormal what we're seeing. And we can see that looking back in history. You know, before 2020, from the research that he's seen, he told me that around 200 giant sequoias died in high severity fires over a very long period of time. And then suddenly, just in the last 2 years, we lost this, you know, massive amount.
Yeah, 10,000.
And then 2020, we lose 9 to 13% of the population, and 21, 3 to 5%. So we go from losing just over 200 trees in 2,000 years to nearly 20% of the population in 2 years. And that is a catastrophe.
So that's why I think giant sequoias are a good example of the change we're seeing here. You know, like I said, we've seen fires before, but these high severity fires are having really unprecedented consequences. And, you know, this idea of these parks lasting forever, just like the idea of giant sequoias being able to just live forever, that's really being challenged. And we're seeing, you know, all those changes and having to grapple with that reality.
Yeah, what I'm hearing is sequoias were really kind of like this anchor of being able to weather, you know, the challenges of centuries and millennia, and that's now they're being impacted. Obviously, this is probably at the forefront of Yosemite. How are parks addressing this new reality?
Right. So, you know, in recent years, the Park Service has had to do a lot of work in rethinking their ideology to adapt to all this wildfire damage. Historically, they've kind of had more of a leave it alone approach. Basically, when parks were first formed, they were often formed with conservation in mind. You know, even in California, some of the first parks like Yosemite were formed kind of in part because of giant sequoias and a desire to preserve them. And the idea was just no logging, leave it entirely alone. We shouldn't interfere. It just really imagined a nature where things were left alone and humans didn't have, you know, interference in that. But that approach doesn't actually line up with the history of this environment, which a lot of researchers have been learning, Western researchers have been learning over the past couple decades. You know, basically, the short of it is that indigenous peoples have cared for this, you know, area of land for a really long time, and that care took active participation. So this is something that, you know, California officials have been recognizing on a larger level, too. That indigenous peoples conducted things like prescribed burning in these areas long before settlers arrived. And they had a lot of other methodologies, too, and just really understood what it meant to take care of this forest by actively participating in it. So now that's what parks have to do. They have to figure out what their, you know, active part in this looks like. And, you know, Garrett talked to me about that. One example he gave me was the Park Service coming out with this new framework in the last few years called RAD, R-A-D, cool acronym.
Yeah, really.
The R stands for resist, which refers to preservation, keeping some things as they are, which is kind of the historical approach. A stands for accept. So that means acknowledging that there are some parts of these changes that the park can't control, you know, like when a giant wildfire steps in. And then D stands for direct, which means controlling change whenever possible, like directing forest growth. So, you know, this ideology and carrying it out, you know, Garrett told me it's still in its early stages, but it really shows how the Park Service is just reconsidering its role and what preservation means.
The world's so different than it was 50 years ago. We really need to take a harder look at what we're doing or not doing. You know, it is action. Taking action, the same thing as taking inaction. Taking inaction is a management decision. Taking action is a management decision. Each one of them will lead to something.
And if you're following, you know, the understanding of why these wildfires have been popping up so intensely, you know, a lot of that is because of this buildup of fuel on the forest floor. So all this stuff that lower severity fires used to kind of clear out. Now they're just staying on the forest floor because of the lack of active management, like during the 1900s. And that just really goes to show that, you know, this idea of doing nothing is not the same as actually doing nothing. It does have an effect doing some other action.
Yeah, like nearly a century of fire suppression and not introducing good fire into landscapes like Yosemite. This is so much to take in, and it's also just, it's emotional. It's so heartbreaking, especially for people who are seeing these impacts firsthand. How did the researchers you talked to say they're dealing with all of this?
I think that there's a lot of grief, you know, and all the researchers I've spoken to, especially those that have been living in an area for a long time, it's hard not to feel, you know, sad about the impacts of these environmental disasters and really, you know, the sadness of having to really reckon with that.
It's more than just their work. It's their home. They live there in Wawona, some of them.
Exactly. And just know it's like the back of their hand. And, you know, seeing that change is just, you know, really shocking, of course. It just takes a lot to say goodbye to the idea of a place you once had and really metabolize, you know, what you have to do about its future, you know, accepting that. I mean, even in my own life, this was something that I talked about with one of the researchers. We were just talking about how when we were kids, evacuations and smoky summers were not the norm, you know, and I just really took that for granted, I guess. And now I personally am looking ahead at the rest of my life and thinking about the idea of these smoky summers just being something that I will be looking forward to. And really accepting that and dealing with that reality rather than just kind of still putting in the framework of like, oh, you know, the strange thing that's happening.
Yeah, because, like it's an anomaly, but it's not.
Exactly. It's not so strange when it happens every year now. So anyways, I talked to Breezy about it just because I was curious about how she's been adapting her own mentality and thinking around this. And she told me how she's tried to reframe it.
I've started to think of summer, particularly late summer in the Sierra, as winter, because it's a time where it's hard to go outside, and because it's too hot and too smoky and too crowded and too dangerous. And so it's a time to rest and hunker down and be with family and be in that winter space of waiting out the hard times.
But, you know, that doesn't mean it's time to give up. There's so much work to do. Breezy talked to me about the need for funding efforts to not just combat wildfires, but also prepare for fires in the future. You know, there's a lot of forest in Yosemite that hasn't been treated in decades, you know, 100 years, for example. And the Park Service is working to close that gap and figure that out. But that requires funding, and also, you know, more than funding, people. Like, they just need people on the ground. It's a lot of hard work.
Resources, yeah.
Exactly. There's just a huge need there, is what Breezy told me. And in her own personal life, she told me that she's not giving up. She's lived in Yosemite, you know, for the past more than a decade, been through multiple evacuations because of wildfires in her area. But she told me she's not planning on leaving.
Yosemite definitely feels like home. Like, when I walk in the forest and I smell the bear clover, which has this very pungent, unique fragrance, I just feel so at home, and I want to protect this place so much. And at this point, it feels like it would be almost impossible to leave because of that intense desire to be here and protect my home.
And I'm, you know, as I was finishing this story, I just kept thinking that, you know, this is something that, you know, everyone can hopefully carry with them, the idea that, you know, we love this place, and hopefully that is fuel for us to keep fighting to, you know, make it better.
Right. I mean, we're talking about one of the most famous national parks, but I think what Breezy just said, so many people across the state can relate to in their own backyards, because we're all impacted by wildfires in one way or another.
Exactly. And it's like this idea that things are changing before our eyes, but also the end is not going to come right in the next 50 or even 100 years. You know, as long as we're both alive, this work is going to have to continue. So that's something that we can think about, too.
Manola, thanks for taking the trip and sharing what you learned.
Thank you for having me.
That is CAP Radio environment reporter Manola Sakaida. You can read her reporting at capradio.org. Still ahead, Farm to Fork takes over Capitol Mall this weekend. We'll give you the rundown of all the experiences to enjoy and soak in. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Sacramento was long known as a city of trees, but in recent years, the city has officially shifted to becoming the farm-to-fork capital. The region's most anticipated music and food festival will return to Capitol Mall this weekend. The Farm-to-Fork Festival, which began in 2013, is a gastronomical celebration of Sacramento and pays homage to the farmers and chefs who feed the region. The two-day festival hosts various demonstrations, exhibits, and discussions on food advocacy, providing a seat at the table for the diverse population that calls Sacramento home. To tell us more about all the food options and the music and what to expect is Mike Testa with Visit Sacramento. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Vicky.
So this has evolved from 1 year to the next to the next. We're almost at a decade now. What can a first-time festival goer expect this weekend?
Well, the Farm to Fork Festival is really about celebrating Sacramento's heritage. So, you know, one of the things we do better than anybody else in the country is grow food. So at this festival, we've got a lot of farmers and ranchers. We've got a lot of restaurateurs. We've got grocery stores with the giant produce section. So the idea is really to get a snapshot of what Sacramento is. When you come to this festival, it is a local celebration on who we are.
You know, what goes into organizing this? Because this is really just like a feat. I mean, every year I go, there's tons of swag that you can get from vendors. But you have music, you have demonstrations, you have learning experiences. I mean, how do you put all this together?
Yeah, it's interesting. The first year we hosted, there was about 20,000 people. Pre-pandemic, we were well over 100,000 people. That's what happens when you have a free festival.
Yeah.
But to your point, we have four stages. Three of them are cooking demo stages with local chefs and different people from the region. Winemakers are there talking about how to pair food with wine. And then we have a music stage as well. So, you know, the idea is to get people to come out for the music in some ways, because not everybody thinks they want to do a cooking demo stage. But when they get out there, it's such a fun time. And again, so many people walking around just enjoying different parts of Sacramento. And you've been there. The smells just walking up and down the street with everybody cooking is pretty cool.
You leave well fed. That's
for
sure. I was looking at the itinerary for this year. You have drag queen Miss Dumi Moore leading an exhibit on cooking. You have hand-pulled noodle demonstrations, presentations on chefs, as also community advocates, and discussions about women in hospitality. I mean, talk to us about kind of leading with a wide representation of such a diverse group that who are all Sacramentans.
Yeah, the one thing that everybody has in common is that we all eat, right?
Yeah.
So it's easy to put together programming that appeals to a number of different people. One of the things that's new this year, we've worked with the James Beard Foundation to do a James Beard stage. If you are in the chef community or restaurateur, James Beard is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
So to have local chefs, and we're also bringing some different chefs in from California, that's a new element this year. One of the things I'm really excited about is the West End. We have brought in something that we've not done before. The West End in Sacramento was really the central business district way early in the 19th century, 20th century. And so what we've done is we've partnered with the Last Supper Club to talk about the food then. You know, this was 70% of that population there was non-white. So you talk about the heritage of Sacramento. We want to make sure we're telling that story. There were jazz legends that came through Sacramento, you know, the Billie Holidays and the Cab Calloway. So we've created something called the West End that will celebrate the food, the music, and everything that was going on during that time. So all of that is part of Farm to Fork. Again, we're celebrating the region, and that's part of our history.
It's celebrating, but it's also taking an honest look at what happened. I have a lot of friends that are talking about the West End culinary experience, which I believe is on Friday.
Correct.
And it really just highlights the displacement of a culturally diverse population lost to redevelopment. And we've had the Last Supper Society on Insight not too long ago. What led to this partnership? Because it's not just enjoying a lot of food, celebrating the diversity of Sacramento for this experience, but it's also telling the story of history.
Yeah, I think it's being deliberate in telling that story. When we met with Last Supper Society, we told them, we don't know this as well as you do. This is something that you guys have studied and understand it better than anybody else. So we want you to tell that story. We want you to be factual. We don't want you to hold anything back. Let's make sure that this generation knows what happened in the past so they can appreciate it and continue that moving forward.
Yeah. And the Last Supper Society, I mean, it's important to establish, I mean, they're locals, they're a relatively young group, and they're young and progressive. And this culinary organization where you can head over to dinner at Tiger in downtown Sacramento, there's like this up and coming generation that's now being incorporated into what has long been an established, you know, farm to fork scene in Sacramento.
Yeah, these guys are really incredible. I mean, they bring such passion. And that's the point, you know. At Visit Sacramento, one of the things that we talk about is we're really good at putting on events. We're really good at marketing. But we refer to the people who know the history. We're not trying to tell somebody's story that we're halfway educated on. So we try to contract with groups who know that history and who can tell that story very factually.
Yeah, approaching it with humility. You know, one other thing, when looking back at the legacy of Sacramento, especially the wine region, you're going to have the Bogle family share a history presentation. What's that going to look like?
You know, when you talk about wine in this region, I mean, the Bogle family has been producing wine for 50 years, and they remain a family business. So I forget how many cases they produce a year. It's like 2 million cases there, and an international brand. So again, when you talk about farm to fork, they're down the road from downtown Sacramento, 20
down the
minutes.
Delta.
Yeah. And they can tell that story better than anybody else, because not only do they grow grapes for their wines, but they grow grapes for wineries in Napa. So when you talk about Northern California and wine, Bogle are the experts.
This festival is also including some pretty cool music headliners. There's Japanese Breakfast, Gregory Porter. You know, what led to the diverse selection of musical talent? What goes into that, into enticing them to come to Sacramento and the Farm to Fork Festival?
We brainstorm at the beginning of the year, what type of talent do we want out there? And we try to do not just one genre of music. We try to mix it up so that, again, whatever your taste in music is, there's a piece for you at the Farm to Fork Festival. Japanese Breakfast, we selected them and reached out to their management. And they were just kind of up and coming. And little did we know, 3 weeks after we signed them, they would be on Saturday Night Live.
Oh, yeah.
So they are, you know, they've blown up in a really good way. Gregory Porter, one of those things, I'm not incredibly familiar with his music, but somebody came into my office and said, we got Gregory Porter? So the following for these bands is really good. And again, there's a little bit of country Americana. There's some soul. There's some jazz in there. So we really try to mix it up.
I mean, Mike, you've long been embedded in Sacramento. I would imagine you learn a great deal every year.
I do. You know, it's funny. I you think you know it, right? And we have people that live in Sacramento that will pick up our visitor guide and thumb through it and say, I have no idea. And I do the same thing at the Farm to Fork Festival. Every year there's something I didn't realize what's happening in this region. So it's a really cool way to kind of re-fall in love with Sacramento.
Yeah. You know, when it comes to actually participating as a vendor, that can be costly for some people. You've actually found a way to partner with Bank of America to waive vendor fees for first-time vendors who are people of color. How was this idea conceived?
So Sonia Bradley, who's our chief officer of diversity, equity, and inclusion, has long been embedded in this community. And one of the things she talked about is we want to make sure that this festival is accessible to everybody. It's one thing to make it free for the public. It's another thing for the vendors to be able to get in. So we essentially ran a campaign where we had interest from vendors who wanted to be a part of it, who didn't have the ability to pay the fee. And so, like you said, thanks to Bank of America, we were able to underwrite their cost to get into the festival. It's the second year we've done this. We expanded it this year, and the reception has been very good. And I know after last year, one of the groups saw their sales fairly dramatically increase after the festival. So it's exposure for these groups. You know, sometimes you don't know they exist until you see them at something like this, and then you go back to their place of business.
Since 2013, how have you seen the dividends pay off for vendors that participate at Farm to Fork?
It's interesting. You know, these food trucks, as an example, they do so many different festivals. What I always appreciate is they are lined up to do the Farm to Fork Festival, which tells me that we're charging the right price for them to be involved, and they're seeing a big revenue collection. So same with the restaurants, same with a lot of the farmers, and just individual vendors selling honey or lemonade. They're seeing tremendous value in the festival because of the number of people who come and because, frankly, of the rates that we charge. You know, we're not trying to get rich on vendor fees. We're trying to create an experience for the attendees.
Yeah, what I love about the Farm to Fork Festival, or just festivals in general, is that, especially in Sacramento, I kind of get locked into my neighborhood in terms of where I like to eat, where I like to go. But when you go to the Farm to Fork Festival, it gets you out of your neighborhood and out of what's routine in your comfort zone. And you get to explore, you know, different cuisines from different parts of the city and the region overall.
And that's exactly what happens. Again, I think people walk through and see something or taste something they didn't know was in Sacramento. And like you said, it may not be very far from where they live, but if they haven't gone outside of their neighborhood, and, you know, Nash and Proper is a great fried chicken group that's out there every year, and their line is always the longest, so I just try to hit them first thing in the morning.
Yeah.
But that's where I was introduced to them, at that festival. I hadn't seen them before, and now I'm a customer whenever they drive by.
Yeah, I love Nash and Proper. I very rarely will wait in line at that length, but they are definitely worth it. When it comes to the grant recipients from this year, who are some of them? The vendors that actually had some partnerships with Bank of America, or which vendors are you looking forward to? What are some things that we haven't covered that people should know about this weekend?
Well, there's a couple of nonprofits that are out there, food related and food specific, and I think those are really powerful. You know, for many of us who go to the grocery store, who go to restaurants to get our food, we don't always understand the struggle that others have. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the things you'll see this year is some of the vendors out there will talk about that, how people don't have the same access to food across the Sacramento region, and that there's a number of programs helping them to try to do that. And then you'll also see just some really amazing food, some restaurants, again, that you probably haven't heard of that haven't been to the festival before. We've got a lot of first-time vendors this year. So I'm excited to see that and get people exposed to what they do.
Visit Sacramento focuses on tourism, and this is a celebration of the Sacramento region. But have you seen in recent years people coming from out of town to experience this festival?
Without question. We track these things. We actually had somebody from Alaska come last year.
Wow.
And we were able to track them down because we knew where they were staying. And we asked them, did you come specifically for this festival? And they had. They were making it a Northern California tour. They were going to Napa and San Francisco. But their first stop was the Farm to Fork Festival. So it's the other thing that we've heard from some of the bands that we've booked over the years. They're now calling us in advance saying, what does 2023 look like for the Farm to Fork Festival? So the word has gotten out, which is obviously really positive. We drive a lot of folks from this region to the festival. But certainly, when you book a band like Japanese Breakfast, who has a huge Bay Area following, we expect a lot of folks from the Bay Area this weekend.
Yeah, and it's a free festival.
Yeah, it's tough to beat the price, right? Mm-hmm. You're not going to get sold out from a ticket because they're all free. And you know, you could theoretically walk around that festival, have a great time, and never spend a dime.
The last couple of years that we've talked, Mike, we haven't had, you know, the best conversations when it comes to Sacramento's economy and the tourism economy, but it really seems like we're making a pivot and we're making a hard left for the better. What are things looking like now?
They're certainly better than they were last year. You know, we're at about 89% of our hotel revenue collections and the city's transient occupancy tax. That's one of the ways that we judge it, how many people are staying in hotels. What we're still struggling with is business travel. There's a lot of corporations, whether they think a recession is looming or their profits are not where they were. You know, the folks that would send four people to a convention are now sending one person to a convention. So these things are still happening. They're just a little lighter from an attendance standpoint than they were pre-pandemic. But they are going in the right direction, so we're feeling optimistic.
When it comes to the convention center, it underwent this major like facelift and renovation, but of course during the pandemic, how is convention traffic looking? I mean, it's probably not up to scale as you would like, given what you just said, but overall, how's it going?
It's good. I mean, the volume of conventions is where we want it to be. It's the attendance that still continues to struggle. And I think part of it is still, you know, there's still some COVID fear out there. I think people are hesitant to get on an airplane. But when I look at the calendar, you know, the volume is where we want it to be. It's just a matter of when will the attendance start to pick up. And, you know, the data shows that will happen mid-year next year. So we're hopeful that the data is correct.
When it comes to this evolution of hybrid or remote work, how is that still impacting the city center, the core of small businesses that rely, especially when you think about the state capital, that rely on people to eat lunch there and head there after work?
It's a huge impact. I mean, you think about, you know, the convention that we thought would draw 6,000 people is drawing 3,000 people, but also the state workers. You know, 30% of Sacramento's workforce is state workers, and a lot of them are staying home. Obviously, there's some that don't have the ability to work from home, but that is probably my biggest concern right now. What does that look like in a couple years? If we lose 30% of our workforce downtown, which is effectively 70 to 80,000 people, that's a huge hit to our businesses. And it will mean more restaurants will close. And for me, as the guy driving tourism, part of the thing I push is Farm to Fork and our restaurants. So if I don't have that vibrant restaurant scene, it's going to be a lot tougher to attract the tourists.
What can we look forward to on the positive end for the rest of the year? I mean, there was the World Butcher Challenge at Golden One Center. We had the head of Taylor's Market on for that. There's just a lot of fun things that are happening, and like the Butcher's Challenge for the first time.
Yeah, you know, between now and the end of October, there's a lot going on. Obviously, Farm to Fork this weekend. October 7th, we host Aftershock, which is the largest hard rock festival in the United States.
Is that two weekends again?
No, it's 4 days starting on the 7th, but then the next weekend is Golden Sky, which is the country music festival that we're bringing in for the first time. So that's Tim McGraw and a number of other headliners. So between those two events, we expect about 200,000 people in the market. 65% of those are from outside this region. And then the weekend after Golden Sky, we host Iron Man. So again, wow. October is a jammed month for tourism.
Back to back to back.
Yep.
We talked years ago about the lack of hotel occupancy. That is changing now. We have some nice hotels that are being built. What does occupancy look like when you're talking about a music festival or back-to-back music festivals from Aftershock to a country festival where you're going to have tens of thousands of people in Sacramento.
Yeah, Aftershock, that weekend, the hotels will be full. From Davis to Rockland, the hotels will be full. I think Golden Sky the weekend after, you'll see something very similar. It's the first year, so it's going to take a little bit to grow. And same with Ironman. You've got 4,300 athletes, and they don't come by themselves. If you do an Ironman, you want everybody to witness it, right? So they've got family and friends. So, you know, the hotel rooms filled for that will also be significant. So again, September, October, if that could be the, you know, the benchmark for the rest of the year, we'd be in perfect shape. But it's going to be a great 6 weeks or so.
Finally, what are some of the big issues that you're still talking about with your colleagues at the city and just across the region about, you know, what Sacramento and the greater what 6 or 8 county region faces in the months and years to come? Because we still have issues with supply and inflation and gas has come down, but, you know, it's still expensive.
Yeah. You know, from a tourism standpoint, we are a drive-in market versus San Francisco, which is a fly-in market. So when gas prices are high, it absolutely impacts who comes into this region. I think, again, that the conversation of state workers and overall building occupancy downtown is a significant issue. If you look at, you know, the buildings that we have downtown, a lot of them are still shuttered. And I think there's a perception that downtown isn't safe. And I've heard from people in Roseville and Oak Grove that, oh, we just don't come downtown anymore. And those of us who are there on a daily basis, you know, things are different, but I wouldn't call them unsafe. So I think there's a perception issue with downtown that needs to change. And I'm hopeful as the economy starts to recover, as COVID is further in our rearview mirror, some of that will just naturally happen.
Mike, thanks for the time.
Thanks, Vicky.
That is Mike Testa, president and CEO of Visit Sacramento, talking about the Farm to Fork Festival and all things about Sacramento's tourism economy. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you want to join the conversation, you can email us, insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Antonio Munez. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.